The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2016 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2016. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at accsedu.org.
All right. Well, it's 4:30, and at the end of a long day, at the end of a long conference, I'm very grateful for you all being here. I'll try to make it worth your while. I think this material is fascinating. I've spent the last 20 years as an academic. I teach politics at George Fox University. I'm involved with the new Great Books Honors program there, but primarily in terms of research and writing, I spent a lot of time with this question. I personally find it fascinating. I do have a foot in the classical Christian world as well. I'm chair of the board of Veritas Christian School in Newburgh, Oregon, and I've had a chance to try out this material some on students there and in other high schools throughout the land. So I'm not an expert on pedagogy, but I do think this is an issue that is bound to come up in any humane letters course that covers American history. It's an issue that should come up, and there's a lot of misinformation out there about it. So what I hope to do over the next 45 minutes or so are lay out some of the issues as I see it, lay out some of what your students and maybe you've run across as teachers or administrators, and then suggest some ways of thinking about how this might be taught, I think very profitably. Again, I'm not a pedagogical expert, but I think one could have a lot of fun with high schoolers, particularly with this sort of issue. So the way I plan to address it is to look at the question, did America have a Christian founding? And I want to real briefly review two of the major answers to this, both of which I think are inadequate for different reasons, and then dive into a way of thinking about answering this question. And I think you'll see almost naturally as teachers at ACCS-type schools how this could be worked with even at a high school level. So let me begin by laying out two answers. Did America have a Christian founding? As an academic who publishes with mainstream journals and mainstream presses, I have to read pretty much all the academic literature written on this question. And there is a lot of it. And by far and away, the consensus among academics at secular schools, the consensus among popular writers who publish books that sell and make the New York Times bestsellers list and this sort of thing on this topic, is the answer is obviously no. America did not have a Christian founding. The founders were deists. The founders were deists who created a godless constitution, in the words of R. Lawrence Moore and Isaac Cramden. They wanted the strict separation of church and state. And, you know, there might have been some religious Americans out there, but they weren't the influential ones. Clearly, America did not have a Christian founding. This is a very, very common view in the academic literature, and it makes its ways into many textbooks. A few years ago, I literally went through almost every American history textbook that I could find, many, many aimed at college students, but some explicitly aimed at high school students, and some of the college texts are used in AP classes, and so I can imagine they work their way into some ACCS schools. And again, usually a short treatment, but to the extent to which this question is treated, the answer is a clear no. This should be troubling to ACCS teachers for a variety of reasons. First of all, it's false. It's just a bad answer. It's based on faulty scholarship, and the logic is very, very flawed. As we're going to see in this, I'm going to argue, and I'm going to point you towards resources that I think document my argument in spades and give you things that you might use if you choose to teach a bit more on the subject. A very good argument could be made that at most only a handful of America's founders were deists. They tended to be the unrepresentative types, the ones that went over and spent lots of time in Europe and things of this nature. When we look at the vast constellation of American founders, we see that there is precious little evidence of deism. Most seem to be, and we'll talk about why this is a problem in a minute, but most seem to be Orthodox Christians from anything and everything we can see. And most certainly they did not want things like the separation of church and state. If I'm right, and I'm sure I'm right about a number of these people, we're missing a good teaching opportunity to see how good, solid Christians thought about politics, how they went about implementing their vision. There are things that I think we have to learn from them today that we might miss out on if we neglect a range of founders like Patrick Henry and Roger Sherman and Sam Adams and others. All right, well, let's turn to the other answer, an answer which I imagine most of you are familiar with. There are a variety of popular Christian authors who answer this question, did America have a Christian founding, with an unequivocal yes. We clearly had a Christian founding. Almost all of the founders in these folks' minds are Christians, even Orthodox Christians, even evangelical Christians. And these Christians went about promoting their views and attempting to create a Christian commonwealth. So people, and I'll read just a few names, Peter Marshall, David Manuel, John Eidsmo, Tim LaHaye, Gary Amos, and a variety of others have made these arguments. They're fairly popular among Christian lay people, and I imagine a lot of Christian schools and school teachers have read them and utilized these arguments. Now, if I had to weigh between these two schools of thought, I would say the second school is a lot more right than it is wrong. The problem with these works, and I think they become a problem to the extent to which they're accepted and adopted and used in ACCS-type schools or any Christian school for that matter, is almost to a person, these folks are not professional historians, professional academics. They often overstate their claims. They often make sloppy use of quotations and evidence and this sort of thing. And they set up what is really a pretty easy straw man to knock down. And to the extent to which people who make these sorts of arguments debate real academics, they get slaughtered. To the extent to which our graduates go off to college and spout off some of these arguments and misquotations and whatnot, they can get in a lot of trouble. And they might start to think, oh my goodness, everything I learned is wrong, at least with respect to this answer. So I want to begin by suggesting that the two major answers that one is likely to find to the question, did America have a Christian founding, is faulty. So I want to provide a third answer that sort of cuts down the middle, maybe leaning towards the right side a little bit, the right side, the second side. And I want to do so in a way that I think should be interesting. And I think those of you who are teachers could see how just attempting to explore this question, did America have a Christian founding, could be interesting pedagogically. I regularly do this with freshmen in college. I'm sure you could do this in high school. I begin to ask by asking students, what do we mean by this question? What would a Christian founding look like? Let's begin with Christian. What would we expect a Christian founding to look like? What would we look for by ways of evidence? And I want to suggest a couple of different ways of answering this question, some of which are more profitable than others. One thing we might mean is that the founders identified themselves as Christians. If that's what we mean, America indisputably had a Christian founding. Virtually every American of European descent in the 18th century would have called himself or herself a Christian. A variety of denominations, to be sure. About 1,000 Jews are in America at this time, but everyone else, actually about 98% are Protestants. So you have a handful of Catholics, a tiny number of Jews. Almost no one's going around. I would say literally no one's going around saying, I'm an atheist. Everyone would identify himself or herself in one way or another as a Christian. So if that's what we mean, it's an easy answer, but it's also not a very interesting answer. A second thing we might mean is, well, we want to see more than that they identify themselves as Christians. We want to know that they are actually Christians, that they were sincere Christians. I would say that this is a very interesting question, but it's a question that's almost impossible for the historian to answer. We might know that someone identified himself as a Christian, that he went to church, that he was a ruling elder, that he didn't cheat on his wife, perhaps. But what does this really show? Does it really shine a light onto his heart? Do we really know what his commitment is? I would say it's just a foolhardy question for the historian to attempt to answer. A third thing we might mean is, were they Orthodox Christians? Did they adhere, to the extent to which we know about their beliefs, did they adhere to the basic teachings of Orthodox Christianity? In some cases, the answer from everything we can see is clearly yes. In a few instances, again, those prominent founders that play such an important role in the more secular literature, Thomas Jefferson, we know from private letters, clearly repudiates virtually every distinctive doctrine of Orthodox Christianity. So we can know for sure that a few, maybe a handful, maybe a half dozen, clearly repudiated basic elements of Orthodox Christianity. For most of the rest, there's no such evidence along those lines. And for many, there's a good bit of evidence that they were, in fact, Orthodox Christians. But still, I would say this might not be the most useful way of thinking about the question. It might be a fun exercise, though, to assign students to look at 20 different founders and attempt to discern their religious beliefs. Of late, one popular question is to ask, did these folks act like Christians? The tenet of orthopraxy. we would expect them not just to adhere to basic Christian views, but actually to act upon them. And I would say this is not a bad approach, but it's somewhat problematic, and it can be problematic for a variety of reasons. Some historians run with this and say things like this: well, these folks claim to be Christians, but they didn't immediately abolish slavery, and the obvious position of Christians on slavery is that it's wrong and should be abolished, so because they didn't abolish slavery, they weren't Christian statespersons. I would say this is just really, it's a silly and an ahistorical way of thinking about the question. Again, one could have a nice, robust discussion about a biblical view of slavery, but suffice it to say, this was an issue very much in play in the 18th century. Christians were on both sides. Some Christians had, in fact, or were concluding that Christianity cuts against slavery and good Christians should work to abolish it. Others thought that Christianity allowed or even required the institution of slavery. To look from our 21st century vantage point back to the 18th century and say, well, those folks did not believe what we believe, is just ahistorical and not particularly useful. Even worse, sometimes people will say things like this: well, we know Alexander Hamilton had an extramarital affair. Good Christians don't have extramarital affairs. Therefore, Alexander Hamilton wasn't a good Christian statesperson. This, I think, is problematic at numerous levels. To begin with, all Christians sin, right? And certainly having an extramarital affair is a very serious sin, but it certainly doesn't make one not a Christian. It certainly doesn't make one a deist or other things like this. So orthopraxy, reasonable questions to ask, but I would be hesitant in putting too much weight on any particular thing we might identify. A profitable way to think about the question, and this is one I would encourage as you might be teaching or thinking about these issues, and it's a very common thing for academics to do, is to ask the question, were these men influenced in identifiable ways by Christian ideas? Now, one of the benefits of this is it's possible, of course, that we might not see someone up in heaven eventually, but that person still could have been heavily influenced by Christian ideals. And on the flip side of things, there might be someone who actually is an Orthodox Christian who we'll see in heaven one day, but was influenced by other ideas, secular ideals, classical republicanism, or this sort of thing. So to actually look at the sort of influences upon the American founders, I would say this is the most profitable way, for my money, to address the Christian part of this question: did America have a Christian founding? Well, I have a nice PowerPoint that I could be showing with some of this, if I can remember to do this. I don't usually do the PowerPoint thing. These are some of the books that one might look at if one was interested in this. Let me move on to what I think is another question that we just take for granted. You saw the title of this talk, you said, oh, founding. I know what the founding of America is. It's kind of an interesting question. What exactly counts as the founding of America? One possibility that people oftentimes don't think about is the creation of the American colonies. If one was going to write my biography, I'm not sure why you would do this, but one could conceivably start when I graduated from college or graduate school or began teaching. But it's also feasible to say that the origin of Mark Hall was as a child, as a baby, as an infant, and you might look at my early life. By the same token, I want to suggest there's three other possibilities for what we might think of as America's founding. The first would be the creation of these early colonial settlements. The second would be America's break from Great Britain. That seems to be a logical possibility, but if you think about it, what resulted from that break? 13 independent states. So one might turn to the third possibility, the creation of the U.S. Constitution. Thinking about the question in this respect gives some sense of development, because I think there is development within America. And conceivably, one might argue that America had a Christian founding and certainly colonial origins, but by the time we get to the creation of the Constitution, it had departed from its Christian roots. And that's an argument that we should perhaps be open to. So if I can proceed along this line a little bit, I won't spend a lot of time on the early colonial settlements, because I think almost everyone recognizes that these folks were heavily influenced by Christianity, particularly the New England Puritans, right? There's almost no question that they were attempting, in the words of John Winthrop, to create a shining city on a hill. If you look at the Massachusetts body of liberties, wholesale selections from the Old Testament are put into this body of law. There are established churches and this sort of thing. To complicate the question, I do want to talk about some of these other colonies. Pennsylvania. I teach at George Fox University, a university founded by Quakers, so we're kind of proud of Pennsylvania, founded by William Penn, the Quaker. And it's tempting to think, well, you have those, from a secular perspective, those mean-spirited Puritans up in New England, but then you have the nice, tolerant Quakers down in Pennsylvania, and aren't they nice? I want to suggest, though, that if one looks a little more deeply at the Quakers, that one sees that perhaps it's even a little bit more complicated here. Here's one of my favorite. I love reading this to my Quaker friends. You look at the Pennsylvania Charter of Liberties. Article 37 has some of what the state should do. The state, even in tolerant Quaker Pennsylvania, should do things such as punishing offenses against God, such as swearing, lying, cursing, profane talk, so forth and so on. Stage plays, dice, May games, gamesters, mass, revels, bull baiting, cockfighting, and so forth. All these things that lead one to irreligion should be prohibited. Pennsylvania actually had religious tests for office. It protected religious liberty better than many colonies. But still, there's a clear sense. If you read William Penn's Charter of Pennsylvania, he quotes Romans 13 to give authorization to the governing authorities and so forth. Even tolerant Quaker Pennsylvania is, in many respects, drawing from deeply held Christian beliefs as it attempts to create a colony. The same is true in the South. If you read the Virginia laws and orders, you see almost right away that Virginia is founded for the glory of God. Offenses such as blasphemy and so forth are punishable by death down in Virginia, and this is true of the other southern colonies, and as well Sunday worship is required and so forth. Now, I'm not here to say these are good things, and oh, it's so sad that we moved away from them. What I think we can say from a historical perspective, though, is the people who founded Virginia and Pennsylvania and Massachusetts were all drawing from deeply held Christian convictions, attempting to create commonwealths, ultimately that were aimed at protecting and promoting true Christianity. This is true from north to south in the early colonies. Again, some people might quibble with me, some scholars might quibble with me about the southern colonies, maybe Pennsylvania, although I think when I present my evidence, it's, oh yeah, I see what you're saying. But that doesn't end the debate, right? Because one might say, okay, Hall, fine, the early colonies were created as Christian commonwealths, but what about the war for independence? Doesn't the war for independence fly in the face of the Bible? I mean, you have passages such as Romans 13, which I'm sure you all know, but just to refresh your memory, Romans 13, the beginning says, "Let every soul be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and the authorities that exist are appointed by God. Therefore, whoever resists authority resists the ordinance of God, and whoever resists will bring judgment on themselves." This is an interesting problem, right? I love throwing this problem at my Christian college students. I teach in an evangelical school. Evangelicals have a high view of the Bible. I'll usually say something like, "Well, you guys have a high view of the Bible, right?" And they, yes, we do. Let's read Romans 13. Romans 13 sure seems to say that one can't revolt against the government, right? And they say, "Well, yes, that's right." So what about the war for independence? Is this just? Is this biblical? It raises fun discussion. I can assure you of that. So how might we think about this? Again, there might be a prima facie case that the war for independence is unjust. However, as you dig a little deeper, and particularly if you reach back to church history, you can begin to see that maybe there is some room for revolution or rebellion or resistance. Right? Americans were a reformed people. I mentioned earlier that 98% were Protestant. Between 50 and 75% are accurately identified as reformed or Calvinist. In 1776, in the very late 18th century, why is this relevant? Within the reformed political tradition, you almost right away have a robust resistance literature that emerges. Now, some people get a little confused here because they think the Reformed tradition stopped developing with John Calvin. John Calvin is among the more conservative of the Reformed thinkers on this question. But John Calvin clearly says that inferior magistrates can stand up to tyrants. All right? He doesn't want the people themselves to stand up to tyrants, but he says inferior magistrates can stand up to tyrants. However, even as Calvin is arguing this in Geneva, you have John Knox up in Scotland saying, no, 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 the people themselves can resist tyrants. And not only can they, but they have a duty to. And this resistance literature is expanded in the Reformed tradition by Poney, by Goodman, by Buchanan, and others. The great track, resistance to tyrants is obedience to God, when, you know, just lays this out. You read this, and these folks are writing over 100 years before John Locke wrote the Second Treatise, so long before John Locke is writing his famous defense of revolution. You have these Reformed Protestants laying out a very thick resistance literature, saying it is in fact just to resist a tyrant. A tyrant, we can go over the biblical arguments later if you want, but at least one of the key arguments is that Romans 13 is talking about legitimate governors, not tyrants. All right? So this becomes, again, it's just part and parcel of the Reformed political tradition in America. Here's one of my favorite political cartoons. You probably can't make it out. One of the issues, and again, there are a variety of issues we oftentimes don't talk about. We always talk about taxation without representation, but how many people talk about the threat that a bishop will be sent to America? An Anglican bishop. There are no Anglican bishops in America. This is a cause of concern. The Anglicans believe that these Congregationalists and Presbyterians and Baptists running around, that they're profoundly in error. Their ministers aren't really ministers at all. And what we need is a bishop who can properly ordain good Anglican ministers who have to be ordained by a bishop. If you wanted to be an Anglican minister in 18th century America, you went over to England to get ordained. So the fear was an Anglican bishop would be sent, that he would start interfering with the traditional rights of Protestants. Some of the early acts even threatened the possibility of ecclesiastical courts, the Society for the Propagation of the Gospel. That sounds like kind of a nice thing. It's an Anglican mission agency. But its first mission is in Boston, Massachusetts. Right? And so these folks are seeing a profound threat to religious liberty. Well, in any case, the image in this cartoon is a bishop has been sent over and he's being challenged by colonists who are throwing books at him. You can see the works of Locke, the works of Sidney, but the work about to hit the bishop in the head, if you can read it, is called Calvin's Works, the works of John Calvin. All right. So these were Reformed people who were very, very supportive of the right to resist. The basic premise of the Declaration of Independence is, of course, a theological premise. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they're endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. This is a theological argument. It's kind of fun to work through this with students. I think certainly any high school student is capable of understanding this. Now, there's a counter-argument, and the counter-argument is, well, we all know Jefferson was a deist and certainly not an Orthodox Christian, and that is true. On the other hand, this raises interesting questions about how you read a public document. There was, after all, a committee of five men who put together the Declaration of Independence. Thomas Jefferson took the lead in drafting it, it's true. But we know, and you can actually find on the Internet pretty easily, versions of the Declaration as it was marked up. We know for sure marked up by Adams and Franklin, but perhaps Livingston and Sherman had a hand in it, even if they weren't physically marking it up. Eventually, a draft was presented to Congress where it was amended again. Some provisions that Jefferson thought were very important were rejected. Others were added. And then in the final analysis, what I would emphasize is this. A group of 56 or so men voted to adopt the Declaration of Independence. And so the relevant question for interpreting a public document like this is not what was in the private recesses of Thomas Jefferson's mind. When Jefferson thought about nature's God, he very well might have been thinking about a deistic God. But what did Roger Sherman and John Adams and all these host of other Reformed Protestants and other Protestants think? I would argue to a person they were thinking about the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, not some vague deistic God. All right, so this is a fun issue to explore, and I would suggest when we look and dive down into it, drill down into it, one can make a very nice argument that the major political ideas of the war for American independence were influenced by Christian thought, by Christian ideas ultimately derived from the Bible, or at least this is what these Christians acting in this era thought. What about the U.S. Constitution? Now, the U.S. Constitution is a fun document to look at from this perspective because it is, again, in the words of Isaac Cranmick and R. Lawrence Moore, godless. The deity does really not appear in the Constitution, right? Not till you get to the dateline in the year of our Lord, 1787. There's no references to God, the Father, nature's God even. It's just not there. it's true that you have these little provisions, such as a piece of legislation, if it's not signed by the president or vetoed, will become law after 10 days, Sunday exempted. That's in the Constitution. It seems to be a presumption that Congress won't be doing business on the Sabbath. Whatever comfort you might take from that, you also have to look at Article 6, Prohibition on Religious Tests for Federal Office. Now, that seems kind of Enlightenment-like or maybe anti-religious, right? So what are we to make of this U.S. Constitution? It's a fun question to look at and to think about. One thing I remind my students is this is a document that is created for a particular purpose. And one shouldn't expect every document to have everything in it. I would guess that some of you people out there might own your own businesses. It would be interesting, and I'll also presume that in a crowd like this, you're running your own businesses and you would like to think, and perhaps you are, running it for the glory of God. It's not just something you do to make profit. It's something you do in service to God for the glory of God. And yet, if I were to look at your articles of incorporation, they very well might not read, for the glory of God, amen. I am heretofore entering into the business of X, right? They might just be a simple, straightforward legal document, no matter how profound your Christian convictions, because that's the nature of the document. The U.S. Constitution had a very particular function. That was to create a national government and to give this national government a very limited series of powers, powers that we can find in Article 1, Section 8. Almost everyone in the American founding believed that the state had an important role, the government had an important role in promoting morality and religion, even Christianity. And yet, what these folks would say almost to a person is that this is not the role of the federal government. To the extent to which this will be done, it will be done by the states or localities, if it is to be done at all. So it's important to keep in mind what the nature of the document is. However, at a deeper level, I would say that you still can find a variety of influences that I think are quite important. Before I get to there, make a couple of other fun arguments. Some of you have probably seen this study by Donald Lutz, published in my journal, my discipline's premier journal, the American Political Science Review. He went through 15,000 political documents in the late 18th century, and what he found is that the Bible is referenced far more than any other document, far more than all the works in the Enlightenment combined. And Lutz's survey actually is biased because he did not consider documents that did not cite secular sources. So there's plenty of political sermons that rely only on the Bible that are excluded from his sermon. And when you start comparing the Bible to particular people like John Locke or Montesquieu, you find the percentages are just ridiculously out of whack. In attempting to shine some light on this question, I've edited three different books. I give you the references to these, where we dig deep in 26 or so founders. We look carefully at the religious convictions, at their thoughts in church-state relations and others. And again, what you find is some of the more prominent American founders, very important founders, did indeed depart from Orthodox Christianity, Ben Franklin and Thomas Jefferson. However, the vast constellation of them, from all we can tell, remained firmly rooted in this tradition. Now, in what ways, practically? Let me give you a couple of ideas. It's real tempting, right, and I'm sure everyone here has heard this, that the American founders were influenced by the Enlightenment, right? This is not an implausible claim, but it's kind of fun to think about what this claim might look like with respect to politics. The Enlightenment, what did the Enlightenment hold dear? Reason. Enlightenment political thought in this era said this, and this kind of falls naturally. They said that really the people, most people are uneducated. Therefore, democracy is a bad thing. What we ought to have instead is government by the elite few. Power should be concentrated in the hands of the elite, educated few, and they can make good public policy for everyone. American political thought cut against that almost completely. We adopted very democratic institutions. Not pure democratic, of course, as all of you know, and I won't even go through how they weren't democratic, but compared to this Enlightenment approach to politics, incredibly democratic, particularly at the state level, even with respect to the national government. As well, you start digging down into this, some of the considerations. One obvious one is the view of human nature. Are humans good or are they bad? Enlightenment thought tended to lean in the direction of they're good. yeah, we can't trust the masses because that's because the masses aren't properly educated. But if we educate them, we can lift them up, and eventually we can reach some sort of utopia. The American founders, as you know, had almost exactly the opposite approach. Humans are sinful. Humans are self-interested. If men were angels, government wouldn't be necessary, says James Madison in Federalist 51. So we adopted, again, almost the exact opposite of Enlightenment political thought, a very decentralized government where the national government is extremely limited. The state governments have the remainder of that power. But even in the national government, we're going to have separation of powers, checks and balances, and this sort of thing, all to ensure that power doesn't become concentrated, because power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. All right, let me just mention, so what I'm going through here is a few substantive ways in which these folks were influenced by Christian ideas. One is their view of human nature. A second one is their view of liberty. And this is incredibly important, particularly as we look back to the American founding to help us understand things like the First Amendment, which protects the freedom of press, freedom of religion, and this sort of thing. Almost all of our students, I want to say all of our students, even those raised in good Christian households, probably if you ask them to define liberty, I'll probably be wrong in a few cases, but I'm almost never wrong with my Christian college students, will say this. They will say, well, liberty means the freedom to do whatever you want except for harm someone else, right? The harm principle. My freedom ends at the tip of your nose. This is not an implausibly bad view of liberty, but it's a 19th century view of liberty. It's a view of liberty articulated well by John Stuart Mill, and it's become pervasive. It is not the American founders' view of liberty. Basically, to simplify it, I want to suggest this. The American founders distinguished between liberty and licentiousness, between liberty and license. Liberty is the freedom or the lack of restraint to do what is right. To talk to any American founder and say, the freedom of press protects my right to publish pornography, it would just be inconceivable. What are you talking about? Law without liberty is tyranny. Liberty without law is licentiousness, said James Wilson, one of the most important American founders, one of our first Supreme Court justices. This is just universally shared. Someone like a Thomas Jefferson might be inching towards this 19th century conception of liberty, but not the rest of the American founders. This incidentally makes it a lot easier to teach things like the Alien and Sedition Act if you understand how the founders conceived of liberty. From our perspective, it looks just like a ridiculous infringement upon liberty. And it was, of course, contested even in the late 18th century. But if you remember what era we're talking about, it makes a lot more sense. All right. This is kind of a fun thing to think about. The founders, almost to a person, agreed that we have to create legislation based upon God's natural law, God's moral law. These were natural law thinkers, almost to a person. Every single justice prior to John Marshall, with the exception of James Iredell, is clearly on record as saying the U.S. Supreme Court could strike down an act of the legislature if it violates natural law. Not the U.S. Constitution. Natural law. This strikes us as a ridiculously activist claim, and it certainly is in a positive legal framework, but not in the 18th century. James Wilson, again, if I can go back to him and his famous lectures on law at the University of Pennsylvania, what was in the College of Philadelphia, he sounds like St. Thomas Aquinas. As he's going through in his introductory lectures, he said there are two types of law, divine law and human law. There are four types of divine law: eternal law, celestial law, natural physical laws, natural moral laws. There are two types of human laws, domestic laws and international laws. Human laws, he goes on to say, must be based upon God's natural law or natural moral law, or they're void. It's a striking claim from one of our first Supreme Court justices. The final thing, and I could keep going in this vein, the idea that humans are created in the image of God. This is just riff for throughout the American founders, and this in part explains how they were somewhat confident that we could govern ourselves together, that all humans are created in the image of God. We all have the ability to reason and create, and we can work together for the common good, understanding, of course, that we all have sinful natures. It has to be checked and watched very, very carefully. Now, you might suggest, and you would be right, well, what about slavery? How can the American founders support slavery if they buy this view that humans are created in the image of God? This was a dissonance that was beginning to resonate among many American founders. You probably know, of course, that between 1776 and 1808, something like 7 or 8 states abolished slavery. The northern states, to be sure, but there was a recognition that there's something profoundly wrong with one immature God holding the other immature God as property. Again, in the South, where slavery is far more economically important, there was greater resistance to this. But even there, you can see people, being troubled by this issue. All right, so there's a variety of ways, even though the U.S. Constitution doesn't specifically use a lot of religious language or really any to speak of, one could still point to and argue for, I think, some profound and important Christian influences. Let me shift gears a little bit and talk about the second part of the syllogism. It's kind of interesting talking about the founders' religious views, ways in which these religious views might have influenced the creation of the Constitution or supported the war for American independence. But practically speaking, one of the areas in which this really comes to the fore is in church-state relations, religious liberty, church and state, how shall the two be related, if at all. The U.S. Supreme Court in 1947 answered this question with a definitive claim. Justice Rutledge, in the important case of Everson versus the Board of Education, said there is no provision of the Constitution that is better informed by its founding, by its generating history, than the religion clauses of the First Amendment. We must go back and look what the founders intended when they created the First Amendment, which, of course, holds that Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. In this case, the justices reached back to a metaphor that was used by Jefferson once, and we'll talk about that briefly, to say that the founders wanted a wall of separation between church and state. And every single justice since this time, who's written at least 4 religion clause opinions, has made historical appeals. Judicial liberals are actually more likely to make historical appeals on this subject than others. Judicial liberals, of course, adopt the following syllogism. We must understand the religion clauses in light of the founders' views. Thomas Jefferson and James Madison equal the American founders. Jefferson and Madison wanted the wall of separation between church and state. Therefore, we have to have a wall of separation between church and state. This is a highly problematic syllogism for reasons we'll explore. Let me just run through quickly a couple of different aspects of this question, looking back to the founding generation, looking to the wider constellation of founders to see what we can see. With respect to religious liberty, I'm very happy to say that there was profound consensus. Americans supported religious liberty, the freedom to worship God according to the dictates of conscience. This is very important, let me just say as an aside, as religious liberty comes under increasing assault in the 21st century. Historically in America, there has been a consensus, Federalists, Anti-Federalists, Democrats, Republicans, well into the late 20th century. The Religious Freedom Restoration Act, passed with only 3 dissenting votes in Congress, signed into law by President Bill Clinton. Everyone, until the last 8 years or so, seemed to be in support of religious liberty. One of the great early articulators of this is George Mason. This is kind of a fun document that most people don't teach, but actually was far more influential than any other document in the era, including the Virginia Statute for Religious Liberty. Mason lays out the argument for religious liberty. Let me just quote briefly from this, that as religion, or the duty which we owe our divine and omnipotent Creator, and the manner of discharging it, can be governed only by reason and conviction, basically men should be free to exercise their religion as they see fit. Note the grounding of this argument, though, that as religion, and by religion he meant Christianity, religion is routinely used for Christianity, although, as we'll see, it would apply to other religions. But keep in mind, there are virtually no other religions among Americans of European descent. There are about 1,000 Jews in America at the time. No other non-Christian religions are represented. But the point is, the grounding, that as religion, or the duty which we owe to our divine and omnipotent creator. Because we have a duty to God, we have to be free to exercise this duty. It is not because religion is unimportant, or because we've become enlightened and therefore we're going to act on the basis of reason, or we're just tired of fighting each other over religion. It's an explicitly theological argument. James Madison, in his first public act, steps up and he objects to a part of this. Mason was arguing for toleration. Madison instead said, no, we should make it clear that the free exercise of religion is a natural right. And his suggestion was included, and this went out to the rest of the states. And it's Mason's draft, actually, that was adopted in three other states, was read widely, was debated, and had an important influence in this era. But again, let me just assert, and I could support this for a long time if you wanted, there's just a widespread conviction that the government, that the state at any level, should not be telling people how to worship God or how not to worship God. People should be free to worship God according to the dictates of conscience. A little more interesting, though, is the Establishment Clause. What is a proper relationship between church and state? This is in a state of flux in this era. Should the state have an established church? Should the state protect a particular denomination? Now, again, a very common argument is that, well, people like Jefferson and Madison were Enlightenment deists who didn't want religion to flourish. They didn't want religion to be promoted by the state, and they probably saw it as a dangerous thing. They were tired of religious conflicts, so they're trying to isolate these conflicts. I don't even think that's an accurate representation of Jefferson and Madison, but let me talk about it a bit more broadly. There's a fund. I was in the Virginia Library probably over a decade ago now, going through petitions. Patrick Henry, after the Anglican Church was effectively disestablished in Virginia, Patrick Henry said, look, it's religion. Christianity is so important, we really need to have state support of ministers. And so what he suggested, and this is kind of a liberal way of doing it, if you think about it, he said this. He said the state should require people to support the church that they choose to attend. That's kind of an interesting way of establishing something, right? So if you attend an Anglican church, you have to support the Anglican church. But if you attend the Presbyterian church, you can support the Presbyterian church, the Baptist church, you can support the Baptist church, and so on. He even made a provision for those who didn't want to own up to being a member of a church. They would still have to pay this tax, but it would go to support schools. All right, so everyone has to pay this tax. No one has to pay a tax to the church other than that which they choose to belong. But it's true that some people like this, some people didn't. So there's a great petition from Westchester County, Virginia. The petition for this basically makes this argument. It's a classic public sector union argument. Well, it's really, really important to have good ministers. The best and brightest of our young men won't become ministers if they aren't paid well. Therefore, we need government subsidies so that the best and the brightest will be attracted to the ministry. There's a certain logic in that, right? However, the counter petition came in from Westmoreland County. So the argument here goes as follows. These folks said that religious assessments were against the spirit of the gospel. The holy author of our religion, Jesus Christ, did not require state support. In fact, it was Constantine who screwed everything up to begin with. We don't want the state establishment of religion. He goes on to address this question of clerics, of clergy specifically. He said, we want clergy to manifest to the world that they were inwardly moved by the Holy Ghost to take upon that office, that they seek the good of mankind and not worldly interests. Let their doctrines be scripture and their lives upright. Then shall religion, if departed, speedily return, and deism be put to open shame, and its consequences removed. In other words, they're explicitly addressing this argument. They're saying, look, we don't want clergy who are drawn into the ministry because it pays well. We want them to be inwardly moved of the Holy Ghost, and if we do this, we'll have a pure Christianity, and Christianity will flourish. So this petition, I'm betting few of you have read, whereas I bet almost all of you have read Madison's Memorial and Remonstrance. Both were written at the same era, for the same controversy. Madison's was signed by 1,000 people in Virginia. This petition was signed by 5,000. It was far more popular in the era than Madison's more famous Memorial and Remonstrance. But even Madison, if you read through the Memorial and Remonstrance, he makes similar arguments. He says basically that religion is purer when the state is not involved. Now, you might say, well, that's not his actual view. It was just a view he laid out for rhetorical purposes. But even if that's true, and I'm not sure it is true, think about it. He thought this argument would be more effective. An argument saying religion is unimportant, so the state shouldn't be involved, would be profoundly unpersuasive in 18th century Virginia. So note the principles here. Those that wanted the state support of religion believed that state support helped Christianity. Those that did not want the state support of religion believed that state support hurt Christianity. So basically, everyone wants Christianity to flourish. The only question that's being debated is whether state support helps or hurts us. All right, the final issue I'll address, and then we'll have a few concluding remarks, and we'll have time for objections or questions or whatever else, is this, religion in the public square. I already referenced the famous letter by Thomas Jefferson, where he writes to the Danbury Baptists in 1802, 1803, where he explains his understanding of the First Amendment. He says, well, the Establishment Clause creates a wall of separation between church and state. This metaphor worked its way into American law in Everson versus the Board of Education, that 1947 case, and it is so prevalent that a lot of people think it's part of the U.S. Constitution, but I'm sure you all know it's not. What some people miss or they don't think about is, I'm not even sure why we're looking at Jefferson to begin with. He did not help draft the First Amendment. He was over in Europe at the time. He came back just as it was being ratified. He didn't really contribute to that as well. Some people argue that his famous Virginia Statute for Religious Liberty had some sort of influence, but the actual evidence for the influence of that text is actually quite minimal. So I'm not even sure why we should be looking to Jefferson to begin with. But assuming for the sake of argument that we should look at Jefferson, we would want, any good historian knows, you can't build an understanding of a person's view on something from one missive, right? You need to look more broadly. So I want to talk just briefly a little bit about Jefferson. Jefferson was on a little committee with Franklin and Adams. Jefferson suggested that the seal of the United States of America, the committee was to create a seal for the United States of America, he said it should be this. The motto of the United States should be rebellion to tyrants is obedience to God. That's an interesting motto, right? He got a similar motto eventually, not exactly this, but it's a Virginia state motto. And the imagery, of course, is pretty evident, right? It's Moses leading the Hebrew people to freedom with Pharaoh perishing in the Red Sea. So this is sort of interesting for someone who wants a high wall, a strict wall of separation between church and state. The seal for the United States of America, in his estimation, should be this thoroughly religious thing. I could go on and on with Jefferson. I'll just give a few other examples. Jefferson, at the very time that he drafts the Virginia Statute for Religious Liberty, also drafted a law for punishing those who disturb the Christian Sabbath and for providing for when governors of Virginia can issue calls for prayer and fasting. Even more fun, though, the day after Jefferson wrote the letter to the Danbury Baptist, he went to church services in the U.S. Capitol building, where he heard this person, John Leland, the great Baptist itinerant minister and himself an opponent of established churches, preach. So Jefferson went to the U.S. Capitol building to hear this great opponent of religious establishments preach in a worship service. And he later authorized the use of certain federal buildings for religious worship services. Why do I say all this? I say this not because I think Jefferson wanted the close cooperation between church and state. He probably wanted them to be about as far as anyone did in that era. I just want to suggest that even with Jefferson, that story is a bit more complicated than we might think. Jefferson's views and certainly his actions are not simply reflected by this one metaphor used one time in a relatively private letter to the Danbury Baptist. He saw in many places, a role for the cooperation between church and state. And this is just Jefferson, right? If we look at the broader constellation of founders, we see that most are, in fact, very comfortable with the close cooperation between church and state. Let me just give one example of the many I might give. This is one of my favorite, though. Again, it's one of these juxtaposition of two events. I think it was 2 days after the House finished its language of the First Amendment. So the amendment that says Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion. About 2 days after this, Elias Boudinot, later president of the American Bible Society, he stood up in the House of Representatives and he said, hey, I have a great idea. Things are going well. Why don't we ask President Washington to issue a Thanksgiving Day proclamation. A proclamation not just that we should have turkey in a party, but that we should all bow down and worship God and thank Him for the many good things He's given us. Adonias Burke of South Carolina, I believe, he stood up and said, no, we can't do this. It's a European practice. We don't want to have this sort of practice here. Listen to what Roger Sherman, and the argument Roger Sherman made. Sherman got up, and this is a newspaper account of what he said, a contemporary newspaper account. He justified the practice of Thanksgiving on any single event, not only as laudable in itself, but as warranted by numerous precedents in Holy Writ. For instance, the solemn Thanksgiving and rejoicing which took place at the time of Solomon in the building of the temple, and these examples are worthy of Christian imitation. In other words, Roger Sherman says it's okay to ask Washington to give a Thanksgiving Day proclamation. It's not a European idea. It's a biblical idea. All right? The House agreed with Sherman and Boudinot. The Senate agrees with the House. They issue this call, they request President Washington to issue this call. And President Washington does in 1789. This rich, presidents to this day, Obama, George W. Bush, issue calls for Thanksgiving Day proclamation. They used to issue calls for prayer and fasting. But what's different, if you look back in this era, they're robustly theological. Just to read a brief portion, whereas it is a duty of all nations. Notice how oftentimes, and we could be talking about this a lot more, there's a duty. People have a duty to do things, to acknowledge the providence of Almighty God, to obey His will, to be grateful for His benefits. I do recommend that the people, to the service of the great and glorious being who is a beneficent author of all the good that was, that is, or that will be. And also that we might unite in most humbly offering our prayers and supplications to the great Lord and ruler of nations and beseech Him to pardon our national and other transgressions. And it goes on and on. But don't you love that? Here's George Washington saying, look, we need to beg God to forgive us for things we have done wrong as individuals and as a nation. Washington issued several of these proclamations. Adams issued several. Jefferson thought he couldn't do it for constitutional reasons, either First Amendment or Tenth Amendment reasons. But then you get to James Madison, and he did as well. And most presidents have since that point of time. Again, simply put, with respect to thinking about the Establishment Clause, there was almost no support of removing God from the public square among America's founders. And we err profoundly if we just look to one document by one person in this era to reach that conclusion, which unfortunately many Supreme Court justices have done. All right, so where does this leave us by way of conclusion? To answer the question, I think on virtually any grounds, almost any way you think about it, it is accurate to say that America did in fact have a Christian founding. I think in the process of reaching this conclusion, I'm not trying to force you to my conclusion, right? And I don't think you should try to force your students to this conclusion, but hopefully I've suggested some ways in which you could use primary source documents and in contested secondary source arguments to have a real robust and interesting discussion. And even to think about these things from a theological perspective. I've had wonderful debates with a good friend of mine who teaches at another Christian college who thinks that the war for independence flies in the face of Romans 13. And it clearly is a violation of biblical teaching. This is a fellow PhD, fellow Christian, and he and I differ on this question. So I'm not saying I'm clearly right. I'm saying there's a lot of good grist for the mill here with these sorts of questions. I think as well they raise questions about the relevance of history for today. First of all, it helps us get a more accurate view of American history than we get from either the secularist literature or the popular Christian literature, and I think accuracy in and of itself is a good thing. In some instances, we can see these indisputably pious, godly men, usually men, struggling to think how their faith might affect what they do as public servants, and this might have lessons for us today in Christian schools particularly. I do think it raises interesting questions of political prudence. For instance, let me just mention one. I think it's indisputably the case that the Establishment Clause does not prevent state aid to religion, even favorable aid or favoritism among religions. Historically, I think this is clearly the case. But what does this mean for us in the 21st century? where only about 75% of Americans identify themselves as Christians. If you're an originalist, when it comes to the Constitution, I think you have to say that it's constitutionally permissible, or at least it doesn't violate an originalist understanding of the First Amendment to have prayer in school or things of this nature. But I think there's very good prudential reasons for saying this is a bad idea, that we ought not to have the government involved in writing prayers and leading prayers, that we ought not to have the government involved in subsidizing certain sorts of education. I guess that's actually a position of ACCS, right? That ACCS schools cannot take government funds. And there might be good prudential reasons for having that position, even as it might be constitutionally permissible. So it might be fun to think about some of these sort of questions, you know, what it might, you know, what might work in a context in which almost literally 100% of Americans of European descent are Christians, versus where we are today, where only about 75% identify themselves as Christians. And of course, a good chunk of that 75 might never darken the door of a church and that sort of thing. One other thing I'll mention, particularly in light of some of the contemporary debates, one of my favorite letters in thinking about religious liberty is a letter that George Washington wrote to the Hebrew congregation in Newport, Rhode Island. I've emphasized time and time again, most Americans in this era were Christians, some weren't. This Jewish congregation wrote a letter to George Washington as he was touring America. He wrote back to them. And one of the things he made crystal clear is that in America, we speak of tolerance no more, that religious liberty is for all, that if you're a good citizen, you'll be free to worship God according to the dictates of conscience. He's writing to this to a Hebrew congregation. Clearly religious liberty, even though we couldn't imagine a scenario in which there would be significant numbers of Buddhists and Hindus and Muslims in America, clearly the founders thought, Washington thought, and I think others thought, religious liberty applies for all. And that is, I think, a lesson we could bring from then to now. All right, so I will stop there. Thank you all very much. I use virtually all my time. There's 5 minutes left. Any quick questions? Yes, sir.
To what extent would you say the American Revolution was a continuation of the Whig Tory
fight in England, and to what extent was the Whig Tory fight a continuation of terrorism versus surveillance? Boy, that's a huge question. So, what extent is the War for Independence a continuation of this Whig Tory fight? I think there certainly are parallels. You obviously have an important reformed influence in England. It undermines the English Civil War, or supports the English Civil War. You have these interesting cross-pollinations. John Cotton in America preaches a sermon defending the regicide, the killing of the king. And, of course, when you get to the War for Independence, you have folks in England defending the Patriot cause, right? Saying, no, these folks are right. Edmund Burke giving a famous speech where he talks about, well, those Americans are Protestants, and Protestants have a particular stripe that don't take abuses of liberty seriously. So, yeah, I would say it. There's two strains of thought here that really go hand in hand. One of the problems, and one of the reasons we had the War for Independence, is there had been a constitutional revolution in England where you move from a position of a more mixed form of government, limited form of government, to parliamentary sovereignty, where parliament can do whatever it wants. And this is part of what scared Americans to death, right? England said this, parliament said this in the Declaratory Act. We can do whatever we want. In the ears of reformed Protestants, that is just tyranny, right? A government that can do whatever it wants is, even if it's not being tyrannical right now, is a recipe for tyranny. It has to be resisted. And these Patriots in America saw it, and the Whig types over in England saw it. Yes, so there are a lot of parallels. Yes, sir. Yes, here and then there.
I would be interested in knowing how those who oppose the idea that the War for Independence is biblical, when we had the Cromwellian era, and before that we had the Magna Carta, which said, look, we're going to cut your head off.
Yes, so it's a good question. So the question I can rephrase it is, how do the loyalist preachers make this argument, right? And of course, it's just kind of a straightforward application of Romans 13, saying, well, this clearly applies. If you don't like what the government's doing, you can protest it, but you can't rise up against it. they were very unpersuasive arguments to, it is almost impossible to find a Reformed clergyman who opposes the war for independence. There are maybe, I can identify maybe six. I mean, they're almost 98-99% in favor of the Patriot side. When you look at the Anglican ministers, it's split. It's about 50-50. But you might expect this for a church whose head is the king, right? And it's there you find these loyalist arguments very unpersuasive in the American context. All right, one last question, two questions, and then we'll end with X. We're out of time, but I'm happy to discuss this stuff indefinitely with anyone who's interested. Yes, sir. Yeah, that's a great question. I would say what's really, you know, for those of us, and I spent a lot of time working with the First Amendment, First Amendment jurisprudence, and people parse words. One of the striking things, if you go back and look at the congressional debates, is how skimpy they are. And the reason they're skimpy is this. You know, the anti-federalists, of course, were, you know, they said, oh my goodness, this Constitution is so scary, Congress might come and start restricting speech and imposing religion, doing all these things. And the Federalists said, fairly enough, that's ridiculous. Congress can't do this. Congress doesn't have that sort of power. Look at Article 1, Section 8. There's no conceivable power there for establishing a religion or prosecuting speech or whatnot. It's just not a fear. And eventually, of course, the Constitution was ratified, but as a stop to the Anti-Federalists, eventually a Bill of Rights was considered. I think even the Anti-Federalists didn't seem to take it all that seriously, and so there's not as much thought put into these things as we would like to think there was, because it was just sort of icing on the cake. It was a double layer of protection that didn't even really need to be there. But when push comes to shove, if you say, look, Hall, these words are there, we have to know what they mean. I would say the best understanding of the Establishment Clause is pretty well the words that it uses, that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. We will not have an established church at a national level similar to the Church of England or the Congregational Church as it was established in Connecticut. These folks knew what an established church was, and we aren't going to have that. But it doesn't apply to things such as having legislative chaplains, which, of course, the first Congress did. It doesn't apply to prayer and legislative bodies. It doesn't apply, you know, almost all the other things that we routinely talk about the Establishment Clause is addressing. It was pretty clear that the founding generation didn't think they addressed. It simply means we're not going to have an established church. The second clause is a bit trickier. What does a free exercise of religion mean? There's a heated debate. Everyone agrees that it means Congress isn't going to tell people how to worship or how not to worship. Everyone agrees with that. The hotly contested question that's very relevant for us today is, does it require an exemption from mutually applicable laws? If Congress drafts everyone, does a Quaker pacifist have a First Amendment right not to fight? This is hotly contested. It was contested in the day. One thing I can say is that Congress was very supportive of such rights. In the Militia Act of 1789, it created a religious exemption along these lines. But it's a hard question to answer historically. One last question, and then we'll end. Yeah, that's a great question. So the question has to do with respect to democracy and the founders being scared of democracy. I would say it varied. And of course, we have to be clear what founders were talking about. In New England, you have deep and widespread male suffrage. You have things like elections every 6 months, right? You have a direct popular election of the governor, election of the upper house and the lower house and whatnot. So particularly in New England, where literacy was widespread, and this is a huge difference from France, right? There's virtually universal male literacy in New England, and really good male literacy in the Mid-Atlantic state, and tolerably good male literacy in the South. So we're very different than Europe, just to begin with that. There was certainly a lot more room for the American people, and unfortunately, I mean males in this context, often male property owners and so forth, to participate in politics. But they didn't want direct democracy, absolutely not. And they didn't want the people to be able to have ultimate sway. Pennsylvania tried this in its constitution of, 1776, I think it was, where they had one unicameral legislature where the representatives were elected by the people, so the people could have a massive sway. This was abandoned very, very rapidly. So you look at the U.S. Constitution, which I'm sure you're all familiar with, the people have a very important say, right? Basically, whatever the states have for electing state representatives, whatever measure of suffrage, that would be the people who get to vote for members of the House of Representatives. So that's pretty wide and deep. On the other hand, senators will be appointed by the state legislatures, who are, of course, elected by the people in the states, but there's that filter going on. And then, of course, the president chosen by the Electoral College, which, of course, removes the people even further. Senators having six-year terms. Why six-year terms, right? That's kind of an interesting question. In the debates of the Federal Convention, at least part of the reason is that they won't be swayed by passions, by popular opinion, right? If my term doesn't come up for 4 years, I could afford to do something that's unpopular, and probably voters would forget it. So I think you're right. I didn't mean to imply, if I did, that the American founders were massive small-D Democrats. On the other hand, they had a lot more faith for the ability of people to participate in the political process than did European Enlightenment thinkers. All right, well, thank you very much. I'd be happy to stay around if anyone has questions, objections, or whatever. Thank you.